Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
So I was like doing self-reflection and evaluating and realized there's no momentum. I have nowhere to turn. I have nowhere else to... I've exhausted all my resources. I don't have anybody else that I can blackmail or bribe or, you know, guilt into helping me. And it's just... And then I thought about it and I was like, it's just me and Sue. We're the only ones that know all of the details. And then I thought... Well, you know, I was getting divorced, so that consumed me for a year and a half. I didn't. Sue called and checked in on me once in a while during my divorce when she found out what was going on, and never brought up the case. She would call to check on me, and you know, she'd cook for me, make sure I was eating, things like that. And we never talked about the case. And then after. I had moved out of the house, got divorced, and I was going through some boxes, and I had my, that box, and my big case with all my info that I had compiled on Father Joe, pictures, narratives, the crime scene photos, autopsy photos, reports from, you know, everybody, phone records, things like that, and I started thumbing through it, thinking, well, I'm bored, I'll look and see, maybe there's something I missed, there'll be some smoking gun, this will be like that moment that I'll find something. And I didn't. But I started listening to podcasts. So then I reached out to a couple different ones and didn't hear anything. And then I stumbled across yours. And I had to listen to it like 9 times to get the email address because you couldn't have come up with a shorter one. And I emailed you. And then I didn't hear anything for a while. And then I get this email months later, and it said something about you were interested, you wanted to set up a phone call, and you would almost cold called me based on that. And I responded right away, and we set up a call like that night, I think.
On October 13th, 2012, a beloved Catholic priest named Father Joseph Moreno was found dead in his rectory. A quick open and shut investigation determined the manner of death to be suicide. But over the course of this podcast, what we unravel will not only make you question what happened to Father Joseph Moreno, but will make you question, is there a bigger conspiracy behind it? This is Deadly Diocese. Important to note that all parties mentioned in this podcast are innocent until proven guilty, or may simply just be innocent, and all opinions from our various interviews are their own. But let's just say this, we at least have a nagging gut feeling of what may have happened to Father Joe. I never expected to come across a story like this. One in which would change my life, bring new and interesting people into it who have now become family, and brought me and my husband Greg on an unexpected journey we can't leave behind. I have a podcast based on the 7 Deadly Sins, where I investigate religious and spiritual con men who use the word of God to serve themselves and their wicked ways. And I often call upon our listeners to send me stories of church corruption, cult leaders from their town, or any spiritually questionable scam artists they have encountered. So I hadn't seen Joe's email that was sent a month or so prior, but one day on a road trip with Greg, who you'll hear from in a little bit, I wanted to go through the inbox for Seven Deadly Sinners. You know, the email address being apparently a burden to type. It is, I get it, but I can't change it now, though. Sorry, Joe. Here's the email that came in. Would you be interested in a case that's still ongoing? It's about a priest who was found dead in the rectory from a single gunshot wound to the head. It was immediately ruled a suicide. But fast forward 2 years, the priest's twin sister had exhausted every avenue to get the authorities to take another look at the case. With hard evidence, they still refused to re-examine the case. They want something irrefutable that shows a cover-up. The autopsy report doesn't really match the crime scene photos. The only way to prove things were missed was to take a second look with a second set of eyes. And that's where I became involved. My first interaction with the twin sister, I still had some mud on my boots that had fallen off the vault we had just dug up 20 minutes earlier. Inside the vault was the body of her brother. Let me know if I piqued your interest. I'll tell you the rest of the story and where the case stands now. And if you need a little more info, the cast of characters in this story involves an assistant U.S. attorney, Dr. Cyril Wecht, another priest, a missing bishop that was the head of the Catholic Diocese of Buffalo, oh, and Jay Leno. Hope to hear from you soon. When I read Joe's email, I was stopped in my tracks, even just skimming it, and I said, Greg, you must hear this. It sounds like a Hollywood movie. And that email sent us on the trajectory of investigating a case so corrupt that I often lay awake at night thinking about it. But the corruption I mull over has only been met with new friendship with Joe Wedge, who you heard at the top of this episode, Father Joseph Moreno's sister Sue, and so many new friends we've made in Buffalo, and the unrelenting determination to have the truth, wherever it may lie, to come out.
Hi.
Hey, Joe. It's Rachel and Greg.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good, how are you?
I'm pretty good.
Hey, do you mind if, like, and literally you can say no and we can never use this, but, like, if we do this as an episode, do you mind if we record the conversation and...
No, go right ahead.
Okay. I came in hot on that one. I was super nervous because I hate asking people if I can record our calls, but after reading Joe's email, I was just so interested. I wanted to respectfully ask if I could record everything he had to say. And thankfully, he was willing.
I have the crime scene photos. And the photos from us exhuming the body.
What is your role in this?
Well, I got roped into this by a priest about 6 years ago. He was a friend of my now ex-husband. He approached me and knew that I had a background. I worked in pathology in a hospital, and, you know, I got grossed out by a lot of things. I was an autopsy tech. there wasn't much that would gross me out. And he thought maybe I would be able to recognize, you know, bullet wounds, things like that, mm-hmm. and that I would be good to involve him in something. I had no idea what he was talking about. He just asked me, you know, this is a priest, mind you, I'm Catholic, you know, yeah. Catholic guilt.
I'm Catholic too.
Yeah, we get it. My Greg's Catholic, my dad's Catholic. My grandma baptized me in my sleep Catholic, but I don't think it counts. So
my husband was a music minister for the Catholic Diocese of Buffalo. So we knew a lot of priests. And you never say no to a priest when he says, I need a favor.
Mm-hmm.
So this priest, Father Robert, which can get kind of confusing because the focus of the priest the focus of this, his last name is Marino, and the priest that asked me this, his last name is Moreno, spelled a little bit different.
Okay, to clear this up, because it can be confusing, we have Father Joe Moreno, M-O-R-E-N-O, and he is the priest who died, and Father Robert Marino, M-A-R-I-N-O, who asked Joe Wedge to help on this exhumation.
His name is Father Joseph.
Father Joseph.
And he was always known as Father Joe.
Okay.
I did not personally know him. I just heard of him. He was the police chaplain, the fire chaplain for Buffalo. So whenever there was like any kind of incident or something where, you know, the police needed, you know, somebody to talk to, he was always the priest that was on scene. Or if it was something really horrific for a family that, you know, wanted to be there, this priest would always go. So Father Robert Moreno that asked me to do this favor didn't really give me much information other than, here, show up at the cemetery. We're going to be there's going to be some digging. Well, that piqued my interest, obviously. So I went and I asked my husband, I said, what have you gotten me into? He said, Father Rob wouldn't tell me anything other than he just wanted to know if you would take a look at something for them.
Wow.
And when I got there, they were exhuming his body. Priest.
Were they legally exhuming? Like, was it a normal process?
Oh, yeah. This was in broad daylight. It was not like us in the cemetery digging at night or anything like that. In fact, we were just standing there. He, at first, basically wanted me there so that I could videotape as much as I could and document everything because they couldn't go through the Buffalo Police Department because they didn't trust the Buffalo Police Department.
Let's hear that again.
They didn't trust the Buffalo Police Department.
They didn't trust the Buffalo Police Department. And that statement opened our eyes to a whole world of corruption we didn't expect.
How he got involved in it was at the funeral of this priest who had committed suicide. His twin sister, Sue, was at the funeral, was at the cemetery. And just as they were leaving, she was getting into the lawnmower, into the car, and she turned, and there was some Buffalo police officers standing around the casket. They had been at the service and everything. She said she specifically saw them lift the lid to the casket and put something inside.
What?
You shouldn't be able to just walk up to a casket at a cemetery and lift the lid. It should be sealed by them. She swears up and down she saw this. Well, and she said it looked like something wrapped in a fabric or something like that. And she said they slipped it in. They looked like they were looking, like a couple of them were looking around to make sure nobody was watching. And they just lifted the lid of the casket and slipped it in.
I know you're thinking what I'm thinking. What did they put in the casket? And how were they allowed to just lift it up and put something in there? This case is just so mind-blowing. I realized I couldn't go at it alone. I knew I needed the help of Seven Deadly Sinners producer Greg Hunter, who is conveniently my husband. And if you've listened to Seven Deadly Sinners, you know I tend to make risky investigative choices. So if this case is as dangerous as it's unfolding to be, I also needed a wingman.
To recap what we've learned so far, cops put something in the casket. Father Joe was the police and fire chaplain for Buffalo, so he knew the cops well. The twin sister and her sidekick priest, Father Rob, don't trust the cops and are exhuming the body without their knowledge. I'm Rachel's husband, but I was her sound guy and editor before that. So I've been with her from the beginnings of her podcasting. And there's one thing I'm certain of at this moment in time. She's going to Buffalo. With or without me. So I better start clearing my schedule and prepare for her to tell me she's booking two tickets to Buffalo. I'm not a natural skeptic, but I like to consider both sides of the coin. and I can play the role of the devil's advocate well. A priest killing himself is shocking alone. There is a moral code of ethics that drove the man to become a priest in the first place, and I have this idea that a man who devoted his life to God would have been too level-headed to commit suicide. But the cops placing something in his casket before burial seems a little too fishy. I can only imagine a twin sister's grief, and I'm surely she's going to commit to suicide being an impossibility for her brother. But an exhumation is expensive and not easy. She must have been certain she saw a Buffalo police officer place something in her brother's casket. There's got to be more to this story. And at this point, I'm confident my wife is going to chase this story all the way to Buffalo, into the Catholic diocese, and wherever it leads from there, into basements, to convenience stores. But I could have never imagined then where this story would take us. And the corruption and foul play is seemingly around every turn.
You shouldn't be able to lift the lid to a casket right before it's about to go on the ground. It should be sealed. It should be hermetically sealed by then. It should have been sealed when it left the funeral home. So that was the reason for getting a court order to exhume the body.
Interesting.
Then things started getting really fishy, because there was all these reasons that they could figure out. This priest was not mentally, he wasn't damaged at all. He would have committed suicide. He would never have taken his own life. From what I've read about him, or very little I did know about him, this is not the type of person that would have done something like that. He was like, yeah. One of his things was he always showed up with pizza, he would show up with pizza. So, and I promise, all these weird little things, they come together for parts of life.
And Joe wasn't kidding. This whole plot is littered with Easter eggs and peculiar coincidences that feel like divine intervention. And as we've been told while investigating for this podcast, God is the coordinator of coincidence.
That they told me that there was all these other reasons. There's no way he would have committed suicide. Generally, somebody to commit suicide wouldn't pay their cell phone bill 20 minutes before.
Totally.
Yeah, what?
Where was the gunshot wound?
Back of the head, left side, behind his left ear.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wait, there's more to that part.
Yeah.
That's what I kind of figured out, was because where the bullet wound, where the entry wound was, it's possible you could do that if you wanted to make it look like an accident, but you'd need use of your left hand.
Yeah, was he right or left
hand? His left.
He didn't have use of his left hand?
He was right-handed, but he didn't have use of his left hand to the point where he could have pulled a trigger.
Yeah.
Wow. Seven years earlier, he walked into the rectory being robbed, and he got stabbed by the guy that was robbing in the hand.
Oh, shit.
How dangerous is this church?
This church is not in a very good part of town.
We also later found out that Father Joe not only paid his cell phone bill, but paid his taxes the day before his death. On October 13th, 2012. Just think about it. If someone is right-hand dominant and they have a partially paralyzed left hand, why would they choose to complete suicide by shooting themselves behind their left ear? He wouldn't have been able to pull the trigger with his left hand, so he would have had to reach around with his right hand and put the barrel of the gun behind his left ear. It just doesn't make sense. But I'm not an expert. Later in this series, you'll hear from the foremost expert in this field, Dr. Cyril Wecht, and his opinions echo this same logic.
It was noted that it was like 80 degrees in the room. He always kept the room at like 60 because he was a bigger guy and he sweat a lot. The room was at 80 degrees. The rectory is attached to the church. There was a door that was always unlocked, and it was locked the day, this was on a Saturday, by the way, and he was discovered when he wasn't in the church for four o'clock mass. The person that discovered him was Deacon Paul, who's now in his 80s, but this was quite a while ago. In the 70s. This happened October 13th. October 13th, 2012.
Okay.
So Deacon Paul went to go you know, supposedly go and look and see where Father Joe was. Went into the rectory, went right upstairs to his office, didn't go anywhere else, didn't look anywhere else, went right into his office and discovered him. Thought he was sleeping. And said he walked up and shook him and he didn't wake up, and that's when he saw all of the blood. And he made it sound like there was a lot of blood. Like that he was shot with a .45. So you think there'd be some spatter. There really isn't any. You'll see from the photos. So he said he called 911 immediately from the desk phone, which was right behind him. This was a very empty room, too. So there's lots of room to move around. He said he called 911 right away. And then the police showed up, and then, you know, ambulance. And he was obviously pronounced dead at the scene. A little bit more on Deacon Paul. Father Joe had just 4 days before finished an audit on the parish that showed up with $500,000 missing from the parish.
Wow.
And the people that would have had access to that money were Deacon Paul and his wife.
Wow.
That was kind of, we have several different theories on motives. There's actually a couple of different motives. That's what's making this so difficult, because you don't know which rabbit hole to go down.
You can't help but consider, as an outsider living your ordinary life, granted my wife profiling false prophets every week hardly lends itself to ordinary conversations at the dinner table, but you can't stop yourself from thinking, is this a conspiracy theory? Is this person ate up with a false narrative that is finding clues because they are looking for it hard enough? And what I'm most concerned about is, are we going to be on the hook for promoting a false narrative about this man's death if we're not careful? Is this a myth morphing out of a twin sister's grief, manifesting from a good place in her heart? How can we be sure? And this is a dark, hollow rabbit hole to go down when you're trying to be objective and look at the suspicious death of a priest. But when it comes to the Buffalo Diocese backyard, there are so many rabbit holes. It doesn't take a lot of research to realize what Joe is telling us is a real possibility in a place like Buffalo.
From two parishioners, two letters from two parishioners alerting the diocese about some abuse with some specific priests, and it's stamp received from the diocese at the chancery. The weird thing is that all of this was brought to a coroner. She did a shitty autopsy. Mm-hmm. Like, so shitty that it wasn't really obvious to the funeral directors and stuff when they exhumed his body. I stood there, like, in awe, and when Father Rob regained consciousness after seeing a dead body that had been around for 2 years.
What?
Did he faint?
Yeah, he did. It was kind of funny. But,
wow.
So she said in her notes that she had done a full autopsy. A pathologist's name was Diane Birdie. She was a medical examiner at the time. And it's a little difficult to do a complete autopsy without making a Y incision on a patient. We had a second autopsy performed also by Dr. Cyril Wecht. I don't know if you know him.
When it comes to American forensic pathology, there is none better than Cyril Wecht. He is a Hall of Fame player if coroners had such a thing. He has performed over 17,000 autopsies in his career and is most notably famous for being the first civilian ever given permission to examine the Kennedy assassination evidence in 1972. It was Wecht who first discovered that Kennedy's brain and all related data in the killing had gone missing. He has consulted on so many famed murders. For example, the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office called him in for Robert Kennedy's assassination in 1968, then again for Sharon Tate's murder in 1969, and then later for the Sibonese Liberation Army deaths in 1974. And he was also called to examine JonBenet Ramsey, Anna Nicole Smith, and the Branch Davidians after the Waco massacre. He also happens to be a clinical professor at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine and an adjunct professor of law at Duquesne University. So, needless to say, if you're investigating a death, this is the right guy for the job.
brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
We're hooked. I mean, very, very, very hooked. And it's, yeah. I
It sounds like you've done a lot of investigating yourself already for years.
And
you're very well read and well rehearsed in this story, so
very much so.
Grateful to be hearing it at this point of your investigation.
And what's your, like, would you, okay, because already while you're talking about this, like I had said to Greg just based on your email, I was like, this story sounds so interesting that it doesn't seem like it
could
an
be
episode.
Real.
It seems like a series. It seems like something we would work with you on to uncover in a full-on series.
And that's just what we did. We knew this was its own podcast, its own investigation, its own story. That within it contained so many other elements of corruption and cover-ups that it could not be told in this phone call or in a one-hour podcast. We began researching, and everything Joe said was seemingly validated through local Buffalo news outlets and an online activist group called Church Militant. And then I started talking with Joe on a regular basis, which started a lovely friendship. And on our very next phone call, Joe took us back to the day of the exhumation once more.
So he was working with Sue, and at this point I still hadn't met Sue. So it was scheduled for like a week later, the exhumation, and I met him at the cemetery. Sue was, she was there, but she was on the other side of the cemetery because she didn't want to see anything, and Father Robert didn't want her to see anything. And I didn't meet her. She came to the funeral home, and they sat, I guess, in the parlor area, or she sat in the parlor area, and then there was a little drama getting the casket open and stuff, or getting it out of the ground and open, but we... By the way, this was another funeral home that took care of the exhumation because it was Father Robert just had a feeling that the funeral home that did bury him might have had something to do with covering, helping cover it up because nobody picked that funeral home. It was just, it was all of a sudden Sue knew his body had been signed out to a funeral home. She still doesn't know who signed out the body either.
Wow.
Who released his body.
May I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Do you believe that they would cover something like this up so much? Like, is it, in your heart of hearts, do you believe it's possible that the Catholic Church or whoever would do what they did to him and then cover it up?
At the time, like... when it was first being told to me, I would have thought it was crazy that, you know, she's just a grieving sister that can't come to terms with the fact that her brother killed himself. That was my initial thought. And I kept that to myself the whole time until, pretty much until we opened the casket.
It's hard not to have a healthy dose of skepticism when you hear a case like this. When you hear that a Catholic priest has died, and there could have been motive by the cops, the diocese, and a deacon to want him dead. It just sounds almost unbelievable. Until, as Joe found out, you dig up the dead body.
So then the funeral home that it was at, they were going to re-prepare the body for burial and had to do some other things. And they wanted to, I wanted to make sure of a couple of other things that I had in the back of my head when Father Robert told me the story. And I still didn't think that, you know, I still assumed it was a suicide. And then I looked at, and I didn't know where the entry wound, I didn't know anything, any of the details of it, just that he shot himself.
Mm-hmm.
So then as we were lifting the body out, it's like on a, I'm sure you've never seen an exhumation that's not pretty.
No, I haven't.
Yeah. it can fall apart when you pull them out, especially when the casket failed as it did. And this part Sue doesn't know. She knows that we just told her he looked great when I opened the casket and looked like the day he went in the ground, which wasn't totally untrue. His face looked like that. The rest of them did not. Because the casket failed. It wasn't sealed. So it filled with water and embalming fluid and blood and everything else that was in there.
I am not as equipped as you are to I'm not that squeamish, but this sounds really sad and really scary.
Oh, yeah. When we opened the cask, or when we opened the vault for it, there was a noticeable smell, which we expected, and then when we opened the casket, it was, like, almost overwhelming to the point where Father Robert slumped up against the wall, and I had to kick a chair over to him so he didn't hit the ground, but...
I do know the smell of death, though.
Yeah.
I lived in an apartment building in Los Angeles where someone died, and I thought... I think that there's, like, someone nearby, and someone just had a baby nearby, and their actual apartment was near the trash chute, and there was a baby that someone had nearby. I was like, maybe it's just baby diapers, and then it got really intense.
That's a good way of describing it.
And it didn't occur to me until I rode the elevator up with a coroner, a week later, 2 weeks later, that I was like... Oh, that's what the smell is. Oh, okay. Someone died in that apartment, and it's a very, very specific, very, very specific smell.
It is a smell you will never forget.
Yes.
Yeah. And it smelled, and so we removed, and I don't know if you've ever seen a priest, or been to a priest's funeral, but they bury them in what their vestments are, like their robes and everything, and it's layer after layer after friggin' layer. And
all of them? Like, over and over? No, I've never been to a priest's funeral, so they put all their...
So they've got their clothes on, and then over top of that, they have their robes, which is like two or three layers. And then on top of that, there's like a blanket, and then a sheet, and then a blanket. Meanwhile, the body's also wrapped in plastic, too. For leakage reasons, we'll say. So when we got down to the body and everything, you're lifting it up. They had to take everything off layer by layer, basically. And it was, you know, fabric, so it soaked up a lot of the fluids and stuff. So got him out, and as we were lifting him out, I looked, because we had gotten down to his bare chest, and I expected, knowing that an autopsy had been performed, there to be a big, giant Y incision.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at the funeral director, and I was like, hold on a second. And he looked, because he could see the look on my face and saw, like, he knew what I was looking at, and he said the same thing. He was like, I said, you notice something missing here? And he was like, yep. And at that point, Father Robert kind of, like, came around a little bit and said, well, what is it? And I said, didn't you tell me he had an autopsy done? And he said, yeah. And he said, Sue's waiting on the report. She was waiting on the report at that point. And I said, he has not had an autopsy done. Not a complete one, anyway. I said, there's no Y incision. Unless she magically got his organs out some other way, there's no autopsy done here.
Covering this case is unlike anything I've ever investigated before. First off, it's not solved. Most of the crimes I cover involve a prosecuted, convicted offender whose crimes are not in question. This is a true, unsolved, cold case of a mysterious death of a priest who was not only the police chaplain and had close contact with officers immediately following traumatic crime scene work and could have been told something he shouldn't have known, or the fact that he had just completed an audit of his church, St. Lawrence Parish, and found $500,000 missing. Plus, Father Joe was just days away from exposing the sexual abuse and human trafficking the Diocese of Buffalo had been covering up for years. In a meeting with the Papal Nuncio of Rome, that was going to happen the following Monday in Washington. A meeting he was never able to attend. Thank you so much for listening and supporting this investigation. And if you have any information regarding this case and the Buffalo Diocese, please email us at deadlydiocese@gmail.com. That's deadly, deadlydiocese@gmail.com. You will remain anonymous, or if you'd like to share your story, let's dive deeper. This is an ongoing investigation, and we'd love to get justice for not only Father Joe, but for victims of the Buffalo Diocese.
And then after I knew you weren't crazy, I reached out to
after
Sue.
After I knew you weren't crazy.
I called Sue and I was like, I want to take a different route. And I said, what do you think about this? And she was like, it's not going to hurt. So here we are.
We are releasing two episodes today, and then it will be moving to a bi-weekly format. So make sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And please leave a 5-star rating and positive review wherever you listen. This has truly been a labor of love. We really appreciate you guys listening. Thank you.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.